really extraordinary that they are billing this as a new initiative. The question is not the U.S. willingness to use its enormous airlift capacity. It has made that offer publicly. Jendai Fraser, Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, traveling to Khartoum in early November, declaring then, over 2 months ago, that the U.S. was willing to use its airlift capacity to move troops and equipment. This is not new. I think it's really a question of what there is to move in. Most of the time since the passage of Resolution 1769, which authorized UNAMID, there has been insufficient equipment or manpower that is ready or that Khartoum will permit to deploy. The U.S., I believe, has committed to airlift capacity to move a tremendous amount of equipment and men, but those have to be up to UN peacekeeping standards, and Khartoum's insistence that initially, adamant insistence that there only be African troops, ensured that there were very few peacekeepers from African countries that were ready and met UN peacekeeping standards. And the AU is already stretched very thin. It has not met its commitment in a number of areas in Africa, and that stalled things tremendously. The Swedes and the Norwegians pulled out of their offer of engineering battalions, which are key, very early on, as Khartoum adamantly refused to allow them to deploy.
What signs do you think Vice President Kiir was able to bring with him to Washington from Sudanese President Bashir of Khartoum's willingness to accept U.S. flights to what he has previously defended as the territorial integrity of his country?
It's very hard to know what kinds of commitments Salva Kiir could bring, despite being a government of national unity. There really is no unity in this government. Decisions concerning U.S. military transport aircraft would be made by national security, military intelligence, and senior members of the National Congress Party. It's one of those cases where it's not in Khartoum's advantage to tell us in advance what they will and won't do.
Salva Kiir, however, has indicated that he plans to run in next year's Sudanese election for the nation's top job. How close do you think he is being kept under tight rein by President Bashir and his allies in the National Unity Government, and what chances does a southern Sudanese leader have of becoming president?
I believe the election this year, 2009, will be controlled through manipulation, fraud, and electoral rigging by the National Congress Party. I believe that Salva Kiir and other southerners are controlled primarily, not by the elections, but by Khartoum's ability to abrogate the terms of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, which is almost to the day 4 years old, with a secession or self-determination referendum scheduled for 2 years from now, 2011. And I can assure you, traveling in Sudan, talking to southern Sudanese over many years, the vote for secession would be overwhelming. It's very difficult for me to believe that fewer than 90% of southern Sudanese would vote for secession. And this is because of the National Congress Party's refusal to abide by the terms of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement. John Garang made very clear when he was alive that he felt it was the National Congress Party's obligation to make clear just why southerners should regard unity as attractive. The National Congress Party has not taken up that challenge. On the contrary, the violence in Abyei, the refusal to create clearly demarcated borders in the oil regions between north and south, the opacity of the revenue-sharing method, the denial of southerners, either the finance ministry or Ministry of Energy and Mining, two ministries, one of which was clearly promised to them implicitly in the CPA, neither is open to the SPLM because this is where they could actually see what oil revenues are, where the production is coming from, and what they've been denied.
During his White House meeting, Mr. Kiir congratulated President Bush for doing so much to help negotiate the peace deal for southern Sudan. What do you think he told the White House that is needed to prevent the Comprehensive Peace Agreement from deteriorating over north-south tensions?
It's 4 years since the signing of the CPA, and I think it's fair to say not only of the U.S., but Norway and the U.K., which partnered with the United States in brokering the CPA during the so-called Naivasha talks, and which was signed on January 9, 2005. The Europeans, the United States, and the African Union have all failed to invest in implementation of the CPA. It was an historic moment to negotiate that peace, but it has been a very fitful peace, and there are signs everywhere that Khartoum signed it under pressure. But what do you get from a regime that is capable of the atrocity crimes we've seen not only in Darfur, but in the Nuba Mountains, in southern Sudan, in the east? What do you get when you sign an agreement with a regime that signs under pressure? Well, you get an opportunity, but an opportunity that means something only if there's a diplomatic equivalent to seeing implementation through that is every bit as great as the energies going into negotiating the agreement.
Do you think that the Khartoum government can be urged by some sort of pressure not to play one strife-torn region off against another, Darfur against the South, in return for bargaining chips from the West?
Well, we saw during the final stages of the negotiation of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement that Darfur was traded out, in effect. Through May 2004, the State Department and the Bush administration refused to speak honestly about what was going on in Darfur. It was very, very clear that genocide was occurring. But because Khartoum implicitly threatened not to go forward with the CPA if too much was made of Darfur, there was a ghastly silence. Now, Khartoum is convinced that that trick will work once, it will work again. And so what they are doing now is saying, if you push too hard on Darfur, you're going to lose the CPA. It's arguably Bush administration's greatest foreign policy achievement, certainly in Africa.
Now, some Sudan activists here in the United States continue to argue that only U.S. military force will get President Bashir to back down on his bombing raids over Darfur and his support for Janjaweed militia attacks. Do you see the U.S. airlift as a step toward greater U.S. military involvement in the future?
I don't. I think it's very important to realize that there is no practicable no-fly zone of the sort that's often called for. There's no place to base it. There's no way to distinguish Antonov cargo aircraft that are dropping bombs and those that are delivering humanitarian aid and supplies. Khartoum is notorious for disguising its aircraft, both fixed-wing and helicopters. I think it is simply unreasonable to think that short of a robust force on the ground that would disable planes that have attacked civilians, disabling them subsequently, without a force of that kind, there is no way to enforce a no-fly zone. The U.S., let's remember also, has not committed one single helicopter. UNAMID needs 24 transport and tactical aircraft. The U.S. has not committed one. How likely is an enormously resource-consumptive no-fly zone if we won't give one helicopter to UNAMID? It's completely preposterous. Now, the standoff military actions suggested by Nick Kristof in his New York Times piece, to which Stephen Hadley responded, are not unreasonable until you look closely at them. A naval blockade without Chinese agreement in advance to respect it could result in a conflict between U.S. naval craft and Chinese flagged tanker. Are we really willing to risk that kind of confrontation? I think it would be imprudent. I do think that China, again, should be pressured to respect if there should be a blockade, but only under those circumstances. As to bombing aerial military assets of the regime, if we engage in what I call standoff military action, we have no leverage on the ground if Khartoum's response is brutal reprisals. What if after the first attacks they kill a number of humanitarian aid workers? Are we prepared simply to up the ante and keep destroying aircraft as humanitarian workers are killed?
Well, what kind of a tone will the airlift set for the incoming Obama administration, and what will enable them to do in the future?
It depends on Khartoum's response. If the U.S. says, we're ready to go now, what would Khartoum do at that moment? The real problem is getting the equipment that's most needed. It's not simply fixed-wing aircraft. It's also important to remember that it's much more than 24 helicopters that are needed. In an environment like Darfur, when I talk to military experts, the first thing they say is that if you want to keep 24 airframes in the air at all times, you're going to need three times that many airframes. The soldiers from Ethiopia and Egypt have been deployed. The Rwandans have made their full commitment. I don't see any major additions coming soon.
With Gaza so heavily on the minds of President Bush and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, is there something specifically urgent that President Bush needs to bring up in his meetings later today with the UN Secretary General when they do discuss the Darfur crisis?
Yes. Quite explicit threats have been made by various members of the regime and have been reported by the UN, indicating that UN personnel, both peacekeepers and humanitarians, would become targets if the ICC issues an arrest warrant for General Omar al-Bashir, President and Field Marshal. These threats have gone unrebuked, which is quite extraordinary. Never in the history of the UN has a government threatened UN troops, UN peacekeepers, UN humanitarians that it has allowed on its soil. That Khartoum at the National Congress Party is doing so now, and doing so unrebuked, is sending a terrible signal that we hear the threats, but we're not willing to declare that this is intolerable and there will be consequences, and to be explicit about those consequences. In the absence of a response from United Nations, it's in effect giving the appearance of succumbing to blackmail.
What steps do you think the international community needs to take now to convince President Bashir of its determination to hang tough on its indictments and make sure that the violence stops?
Well, that's a very good question. If we go back to summer 2004, when the UN Security Council demanded, the word of Resolution 1556, demanded that Khartoum disarm the Janjaweed, Khartoum sniffed in contempt. The Janjaweed are being mobilized today, even as we speak. I received an urgent communication from a humanitarian worker widely experienced on the ground in Darfur just today, indicating that there's extremely active Janjaweed integration into the fighting capability that Khartoum is once again marshaling in especially West and North Darfur. This has been confirmed by other sources. If we can't produce any compliance with any UN resolution, and there have been over a dozen, how likely is it we'll produce compliance unless we really lay out consequences? The only way we're going to get anywhere is to lay out consequences and make good on those consequences and have the courage to announce them publicly. Otherwise, we are going to see more of the same. And the ones who can do it most effectively are the Europeans. The U.S. has used every bit of economic leverage. Sanctions initially imposed by President Clinton back in 1997 for reasons of Khartoum's support of terrorism always remained in place. The Bush administration, to its credit, has tightened those sanctions with financial sanctions, which severely limit Khartoum's ability to use the dollar in an international monetary instrument for trade and purposes of commerce and for central banking purposes. The Europeans don't even have trade sanctions. In fact, some of the biggest European countries continue to do business as usual with this regime. There has to be more toughness. There has to be more of a response from Europeans. And there hasn't been, and it's been an enormous, enormous burden for the U.S. to carry, especially in the long shadow of Iraq.
Do you see a new perspective that an Obama administration can bring to the negotiations to get President Bashir to act to resolve this crisis?
Well, he's certainly been quite adamant. It's not widely known, but in 2006, August, when he was traveling in eastern Chad, he spoke explicitly about non-consensual deployment of international force to halt the genocide. I believe he was right then. We didn't hear anything about that subsequently, certainly not once the presidential campaign got underway. Darfur was mentioned, but it was never really an issue. There was never any leverage that either McCain or Obama could gain by talking tough about Darfur. So we really don't know. We do know that Susan Rice is what might be called a hawk on Khartoum. She knows what the regime is about. She knows who these guys are and what they're capable of. And she made very clear just how strong her views are on responding to genocide. I think his appointment of her to be ambassador to the UN is a clear signal that the days of taking this regime at its word or giving it the kind of slack that's implicitly been given diplomatically are over. But Obama comes in with so much on his plate with the Gaza crisis, the domestic crisis, the tensions between India and Pakistan, sky high, Iran, on and on the list goes of critical foreign policy issues. Even in Africa, the difficulties in Somalia are enormous, and DRC. It's hard to know how to prioritize one's agenda if you're Barack Obama coming into an enormously complicated foreign policy context with a huge economic crisis looming.
Is there a danger that opening up the process to the inputs of other countries, as President-elect Obama has said in general he wants to do on the diplomatic front, can compromise the effectiveness of putting added pressure on Khartoum?
I think what is needed, and this is something that Khartoum has carefully undermined, is a very public support of Jibril Bassolet, the UN-designated mediator. What we hear about is Qatar. And evidently the talks will be held in Qatar. But Qatar was widely, when it was on the UN Security Council, was the voice of opposition from the Arab world, the Arab League in particular, to responding in any meaningful way to the crisis in Darfur. Qatar is not looked at on as a neutral party, and they essentially were trying to create a new peace form. One thing that Khartoum has been extremely adept at over the years is creating multiple and competing peace fora. What we need is clear, unambiguous international support for Bassolet. There has to be one guy in charge, and there has to be one source of negotiating authority, and it can't be the Qataris. I think to the extent there is international support by Britain, France, the U.S., the European Union as a whole for Bassolet, the peace talks will be much, much more effective. He's worked very, very hard with the rebel groups, and I think has made some progress in establishing his credibility. But the only way we'll get good peace negotiations going is if we have real international ownership of the process and its chief negotiator, Jibril Bassolet.